Welcome to Children of the 80s.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Jim. And if you are joining us for the first time, thank you for finding us, and we want to let you know that this is a podcast that looks back on the decade of the 1980s. We talk about all things that were important to us as children and what we look back on with fond memories as adults. Ultimately, this is a nostalgia podcast. And if you are one of our loyal listeners, thank you for tuning back in. So today, we are looking back on the hit song, We Are the World, by USA for Africa, which was essentially a made-up group of a bunch of American musicians.
Netflix came out with a documentary this year that chronicles the writing, producing, recording, releasing of that song. And we watched it a couple of weeks ago. A listener, Kelly, had recommended that we watch it. It was on our list of things to get around to, but she said it was really good, so kind of bumped it up there, made it a little bit more of a priority, and we watched it. And I really got into it. It was a very well-done documentary that gave some interesting tidbits about the making of this song, the things that I had just never heard.
Right. No, same here. I like the idea, and I don't think I realized it, but they had to do it all in one night.
Don't give away too much.
I'm not going to give away too much, but that's just like a little teaser. You know, they did the previews.
Oh, yes.
They did the previews for the documentary as you're scrolling through Netflix and you'd land on it and they'd start talking. You know, somebody was talking about, oh, here comes this guy and here comes this lady. And so that's just what I'm doing here to our fans.
So you ready to just jump right on in, or you got something you want to recap?
Well, is there anything you want to recap from last episode?
I don't think I've got any.
Did you get any feedback on your Chicago song not being a nostalgia song?
Nobody cared.
I had to reach out to me saying, yeah, Chicago is a great breakup song, but it's not a song about nostalgia.
Who said that? Who?
Well, your previously former favorite person, TJ, said that, and he prefaced it with, I will not be on the top of Lindsay's list any longer.
Well, TJ, I guess we're not friends anymore.
And then my brother, Mike.
Oh, well, of course he took your side.
No, he's not taking my side. Mike will give it to you straight, whether I'm right or wrong.
It's like arguing with somebody that the grass is green. Like, I don't even know what else to say. Like, that's a nostalgic song.
It does not look back on a previous time period.
So, okay, help me understand. So you're saying, in order for there to be a sense of nostalgia, there has to be some time in between the event and then the thinking back on it.
Yes, I believe so.
So you can't have a sense of nostalgia
over something that happened yesterday.
You can't. You need more time. Yes. I mean, to me, nostalgia could be last week.
No, to me,
I could sit here and think about how I enjoyed, the dinner we had a week ago tonight, and it just brought all sorts of warm, fuzzy feelings, and that's not a possibility.
No, if you look back on a dinner that we had a decade ago, and it brought all warm, fuzzy feelings, then yes, I'm with you.
Oh, it's so funny.
All right.
I had even forgotten, and now you got me all worked up about the Chicago thing, and I had forgotten about it.
You know what? There's nobody from Chicago in this group that we're talking about today.
Oh, now you had to go there. You had to go there. Okay. You ready?
I'm ready. Let's jump right into it.
So on January 28th, 1985, at A&M Recording Studios in Hollywood, following the American Music Awards, which Lionel Richie had hosted that night, more than 40 artists gathered to record a song that Richie and Michael Jackson had written to raise awareness of the widespread life-threatening poverty in Africa. You mentioned while we were watching the documentary that I say Lionel funny.
You say it like Michael Jackson says it, Lionel. And Lionel even pointed that out in the documentary. He's like, Michael came to me, he's like, Lionel, Lionel. He's like, he always called me Lionel.
And that's how I say it.
And that's
it.
How you say
I'm
it,
I'm all
yes.
paranoid about it now.
No, just you be you.
Okay, so most of the show's winners from the AMA Awards, including Cyndi Lauper, Hall & Oates, Bruce Springsteen, Huey Lewis, Willie Nelson, like Tina Turner, they were all there that night in the studio after the award show to record this song.
Yeah, that was the one way that they were able to bring everybody together, was to do it when they thought everybody would be in town.
Right. And can you imagine coordinating schedules?
No, it wasn't. It turns out it probably wasn't a whole lot of fun for a lot of the artists there, because it did literally go all night long.
So the
as
new,
Lionel sang.
All night long. Is that Lionel or Lionel?
Yes.
So the Netflix documentary, The Greatest Night in Pop. It's the story of how it all came together, and it's told by the people who were there that made it happen. It includes camera crew, engineers, assistants, and even Lionel participated.
So you know what surprised me most was I did not realize that Lionel was so personable that he made just a great host of the AMAs. I don't remember watching the AMAs in 1985.
He performed that night at the AMA Awards. He performed two songs. He hosted,
right.
Performed twice, won six awards.
Because he was the bomb. I've been telling you that.
Hopped in his limo, raced over to this A&M recording studios in Hollywood. They stayed up all night. They started about 9 p.m., wrapped up about 8 a.m. And he was going from group to group to group, because the musicians kind of paired off, right?
Yes.
Into different groups. And he would and work with them and encourage them and maybe work out any issues they had, and then pop over to the next group. Like, I don't even know how did he keep his head on straight.
So that was what was so impressive about him. Not only was he a great host and a great performer, but he was obviously the diplomat of the group, and he was bouncing back and forth. He wrote the music.
Which is,
wrote the lyrics.
That's where I'm heading next. So the documentary goes back and explores the events even leading up to that night, mm-hmm. when Lionel and Michael Jackson get together and they're going to write this song. Originally, they had wanted Stevie Wonder to be involved.
Yes.
And
Stevie wouldn't answer his phone.
I don't understand that. Like, they said they called him and you just have to wait for him to call you back, and he didn't call him back, and they were working under like a serious time crunch, so they had to just move on without him.
I don't think at first they realized that they were working under that time crunch.
Probably not.
And then as it got closer, Quincy Jones was like, hey, you've got to have this done by this date, and I think Lionel and Michael started panicking a little bit.
So I want to say, I mean, it was within just a matter of days before they all got together to record it. Did they finish it? And then, I don't know the right words that you would use back in the 80s, but they dubbed it onto a tape, or they recorded it onto a tape. And tapes went out all over the world via FedEx to all the musicians.
Yes.
So hopefully they would have a chance to listen to it and learn the song before then they met up that night to record it. I don't think a lot of them, though, actually like heard it. I don't think that the tapes actually made it to them in time. And so that's interesting. A lot of them went in blind, just knowing they wanted to participate, but mm-hmm. really not knowing what they were doing.
Right.
So, and as you mentioned, the decision to pick that particular night to record the single was made in order to piggyback off the fact that so many musicians would be there in Hollywood attending the American Music Awards. Michael Jackson, who was the biggest star at the time, would you say?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. He went on into the studio ahead of everybody else, yes. that night. And he went ahead and he laid down numerous multi-tracks himself. So he started at like 9 o'clock as everybody's starting to get there. And he would record, you know, himself singing like in one key, and then he would come back and he would dub over it, you know, singing maybe the harmony and then the melody and the melody and then building off of that. Stuff like that blows my mind.
So
I don't even speak that language.
You mentioned it while we were watching it, but do you remember Michael just breaking into singing the song without any music and just on the perfect key without any warm-up or anything?
Yeah, I don't understand it.
He was talking, and then boom, he just started, and he was pitch perfect and with no music, and it just blew my mind how somebody can be that talented.
Now, did you take what Michael Jackson was doing there that night as him trying to control the situation, or did you take that as just, that's just him being creative and that's just what he does?
Yeah, I think I take it more as that.
Like, he had a job to do and he was focused on getting it done. I didn't take it as like he was trying to take over. But a couple of things I read suggested that he might have had an ulterior motive, which I just don't know that I agree with that.
So here's what you have to understand about Michael Jackson is that he was a perfectionist. And he would even practice his tour for months and months and months, all the dance moves and everything that he wanted to do on tour for months and months and months with his dancers before they ever went on tour. And everything had to be absolutely perfect before he would go out on tour. So Michael was a perfectionist. And so that's probably what you saw in the documentary, him going off by himself and laying tracks down and everything else, because he just wanted this, everything that he did, but he wanted this truly to just be perfect.
So we've talked about Harry Belafonte a little bit in the past on this podcast. Mm-hmm. I'm learning new things about him all the time. It's really Harry is the one that got this whole thing started. He was very big into doing humanitarian aid. And it bothered him that Black artists in America weren't doing more for the people of Africa.
Yes, yes. Ethiopia, specifically, I remember, went through a famine in the early to mid-80s. So, I'm sure there were other countries, too, but Ethiopia is the one that I really remember.
He went over there, he saw what was going on, and he came back and basically said, like, we need to step up and do something. And he is the one who kind of got that ball rolling. Okay, are you ready for me to list off to you, or do you want to take a stab at the soloist from We Are the World?
Okay, I have who was this, who okay. the soloist were.
Okay, give it to
and
me.
Who the chorus was. So I don't mind you giving the soloist, but I'd like to talk about why they were probably soloists at this time and what they had done.
Okay.
But before you do, you had mentioned groups of people, right? Mm-hmm. So I kind of color-coded the groups of people that they had.
Did?
Yeah, I did. So this was very interesting. So obviously you had Michael, Lionel, and Stevie, right?
Yeah, but they
Lionel
were kind of up there at the, right. the head of
but,
the thing.
But also, you know, Quincy Jones, and you had the Quincy Jones artists, mm-hmm. Quincy Jones artists, right? So Michael, Lionel, and Stevie were clearly the heads of it, but you also had, you know, guys like Al Jarreau and James Ingram that were there, that were Quincy Jones artists. But here's what I noticed. Kenny Rogers, James Ingram, and Kim Carnes all sang a song together called What About Me? So it was almost like a duet, but it wasn't a duet because it was three people, right? So what's that, a triet? What would it, a triune? A triangle?
A tripod.
A tricycle. So those three were together. Michael Jackson, obviously, was there, but his brothers and sister were there, too. It wasn't just LaToya.
No, it was the whole family.
Jackie, Marlon, well, Randy, and Tito were there.
They had just done a tour together.
Right. Willie Nelson was there with his buddy Waylon Jennings, who I'm sure you've got more to say on later on.
I'm a little disappointed there, but...
Kenny Loggins was there. He was kind of sort of with Steve Perry a little bit, I thought.
Yeah, he was.
Daryl Hall and John Oates were there. They were a duo, obviously.
Okay, I've got something. You want me to jump in or you want me to just
ahead.
Let
jump
you?
Yeah, go ahead. Jump in.
Why did it feel very one-sided there?
Because Daryl Hall's the talent and John Oates is the mustache.
Well, you know, I don't like Hall and Oates, so I wouldn't know this, but I'm just like, okay, I feel like one's doing the work and the other one's just standing around.
No,
is that how that relationship went?
That's not fair. John Oates is a very talented musician, but Daryl Hall just had this old soulful voice. Huey Lewis was there, but you know who else was there? The News.
Yes.
All five of them.
Yes, I know.
And let's see. Oh, guess what? There is also a Pointer sister there. Do you know which one?
Ruth.
All of them.
June.
And Anita. Yes. So you did certainly have groups of people that were there, and then you had people that were there that were just kind of solo too. But let's go ahead. You go with the soloists in order of appearance. Or do you want to talk about the chorus first?
No, I'm going to give you the soloist in order of appearance. I'm just going to like tick them off, and then if we got something to say, we'll go back and say it.
Oh, I got something to say about every one of them.
Okay, then let's go that way. Lionel Richie.
All right, so we've talked a lot about him.
Do you think he was on speed?
No.
Cocaine?
No, I don't.
Marijuana?
Definitely not.
The Mary Jane?
No.
Molly?
No.
But no, seriously, like, how did he keep it going?
I don't know.
Just adrenaline, probably. Yeah,
adrenaline for sure. I mean, he had written this song, right? So yeah. This was kind of his baby. But, you know, obviously he was picked because of his songwriting ability and because of his talent. But in 83, 84, he was huge. As you mentioned, what, he walk away with 6 American Music Awards?
Yep.
1983, 84, he had hits You Are, My Love, All Night Long, Running with the Night, Hello, Stuck on You, Penny Lover. I mean, that's enough. That's a career for some people. And that was just a year and a half for him. Who was next? After Lionel.
Stevie Wonder.
Right. Well, that's Motown royalty, right?
But you know what's funny? Stevie Wonder shows up. Okay, so they try to reach him to write the song. They can't get in touch with him. They write it without him. He shows up that night to record. He thinks he's there to write.
Right.
And then they have no, dude, we've moved on without you. But he was good-natured enough that he's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, he was kind of like, you know, you could have called me and I would have helped you. And they were like, we did call you, dude, like 100 times. But apparently his sight was fine. He couldn't hear his phone. So Stevie Wonder was Motown royalty. And of course he had I Just Called to Say I Love You. And number one hit in 1984.
Paul Simon.
He was kind of a legacy.
Why was he there?
So he was kind of a legacy pick. Kind of like other people we'll get to later on. Right. But Paul Simon as a solo artist had 14 top 40 hits. And then he had another 16 with Garfunkel, which was always a funny name to me. Garfunkel.
And you know, they don't get along now either.
I know. What's up with these duos that sing lovely together that just don't get along anymore?
They can't make it work.
They make beautiful music together until it's all over.
So I want to say Paul Simon, he was in what people probably assumed was the end of his career. And then the following year, didn't he have another like blockbuster album?
Yes, he did.
Yeah. Kenny Rogers.
Yes, Kenny Rogers. So 1983-84, he had a duet, We've Got Tonight, with Sheena Easton. Islands in the Stream, obviously, with Dolly, which we've talked about several times on this podcast. What About Me with Kim Carnes and James Ingram, which I previously mentioned. And Kenny Rogers is just kind of royalty, too.
But in the 80s?
He was actually relevant in the 80s as well.
Yes.
But he, you know, going back a long time, Kenny Rogers, very, you know, country music and pop music royalty.
So, I mean, here's the thing. Like, if Kenny Rogers, if I entered a studio with Kenny Rogers in it before he passed away, I mean, I would be awestruck. If you watch the documentary, he was awestruck of the other artists there. He is one of the ones that got started going around asking for other artist autographs.
Isn't that
and
funny?
I'm just like, Kenny Rogers was asking for other people's autographs. That's pretty cool.
Well, I love that too, because I'm sure we'll get to somebody later on when I'll just throw her name out now. But Diana Ross was also awestruck, which totally blows me away, because I feel like everybody, other than maybe Ray Charles, should have been awestruck of Diana Ross.
Yes.
But all right, go ahead with your next
one. And you want to know something interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Stevie Wonder signs with his fingerprint. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah. He does. Ray Charles had impeccable handwriting.
No way.
Yep. James Ingram. I'm assuming he was the one that every time it showed, I'd be like, who is that? Who is that? I'd be like, who is that?
It may have been. He's a Quincy Jones guy, but he also, you know, had some big hits in the early 80s.
I mean, I'm not saying he didn't. He just wasn't recognizable.
Right, right.
Tina Turner.
Mm. Tina made her big comeback in the 80s, yep. right? And so, 84, What's Love Got to Do with It? Better Be Good to Me, Private Dancer, Let's Stay Together, a remake of the Al Green hit. So Tina was, you know, obviously the queen of rock and roll.
Billy Joel.
Billy Joel.
I feel like either he was out of his element that night, or, I mean, didn't want to be there, or didn't like that he wasn't in charge, or I don't know. I felt like he gave off some weird energy.
Really? Okay, well, Billy deserved to be there because he had his Innocent Man album that was a big hit in late 83, 84, had, you know, five top 20, I believe, hits on it, plus the album cut, which I know you love, Innocent Man. He also had hits, you know, earlier in the 80s, but prior to that album, Pressure and Always a Woman, I think. So, yeah, Billy deserved to be there.
And he arrived that night with
Christy Lee.
Yeah, a matter of just a couple of weeks before they got married.
Yep.
Michael Jackson, we've already talked about.
Yes.
He was there that night in his full, like, Michael Jackson garb.
Of course.
The rhinestones, the shiny, the glove, the sunglasses. He was ready to go. Diana Ross.
Motown royalty. She had six number one songs. But here's what I don't think I realized. Did you know that she actually had 11 top 40 songs in the 1980s?
No, I had no idea.
So you obviously remember her with the Supremes in the 60s and then on her own in the 70s. But she kept going in the 80s. And she had one of the best moments, in my opinion, in the documentary, which I'm sure we'll get to later. But, yeah, she was still going strong in the 80s.
Dionne Warwick.
Another Motown, or not Motown, but another legacy artist. Did you know that she actually had 31
no.
top 40 hits?
No.
12 top 10 hits and two number ones.
I mean, I feel like all I know about Dionne Warwick is that she was Whitney Houston's godmother.
Well, she also did That's What Friends Are For.
Oh, that's right.
And she also started the Psychic Friends Network.
Oh, goodness. I don't even know. If she started the Psychic Friends Network, how come she didn't know that Whitney Houston was going to die?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you thought I had a bad joke with Stevie Wonder.
I'm sorry. Okay, moving right along. Willie Nelson.
To All the Girls I've Loved Before. Again, country music royalty. He's also a crossover artist with hits, six hits on the Billboard Hot 100 and four during the early 1980s.
Felt very out of his element.
Do you think he did? I don't know if he did or not. I don't think Willie ever feels out of his element. I think Willie probably fits in with everybody. He's probably like Lionel Richie, right?
Good for him, though.
He just kind of fits in with everybody. We're going to get to somebody later on that clearly seemed out of their element.
Al Jarreau.
Al Jarreau. He had two hits prior to this, and then, of course, he had the Moonlighting song after this.
So I now, Al in this house has a nickname. Drunk Al.
Drunk Al, yeah. Al had a little too much champagne.
The later it got, the more drunk Al got, and the more...
He struggled to sing his lines.
And just kind of in everybody's business he got.
Oh, yeah, he was up in everybody's face, yes.
Okay, Bruce Springsteen, who also appeared in the documentary.
So if Prince, Lionel, or Michael weren't ruling the world in 1984, 1985, then it was Bruce Springsteen.
He had just come... Like off of his
Born in the USA tour. Yes.
Like the night before, like something crazy. Like
yes, he just wanted to be a part of this. And yep. So he flew in. He wasn't going to the AMAs. So Bruce had seven top 10 hits in 1984 and 1985, all off the Born in the USA album, which really cool is Born in the USA was a number one album for a while in 1984, and it hadn't even released all of its singles yet. And then in 85, it would go on to release its singles and then reclaim the top spot again in 85 at some point.
Kenny Loggins.
The soundtrack king.
I was really impressed with what I saw of him in the documentary.
I was too. I did not realize that he was, I probably didn't realize that he was as good of a musician as what he showed to be in the documentary.
Takes us then to the next one, Steve Perry.
One of the great male voices wow. of all time.
He blew me away in the documentary as well. The two of them together, I was super impressed with.
So, and Steve was there because he had four, you know, did you know he had four top 40 solo hits alone in 1984?
Oh, Sherry.
Right. I don't know what the other ones are. I'm just telling you he had four of them.
Thanks.
I would remember them if I still had a memory.
There you go.
But I don't. And he was also the lead singer of Journey, who had 12 top 40 yep. hits in the early 80s.
Daryl Hall.
22 top 40 hits from 76 to 85. 22 in a 9-year period with 6 number ones.
Huey Lewis.
So here's what's funny. Huey Lewis and the News had just kind of come in to their own. They had just had a number one album in sports in 1984. They had 7 top 40 hits, including 5 top 10 hits from 82 to 84. So here's what's funny. These were the 5 number one albums in 1984. And if I read these to you before we saw this documentary, I would say which one sticks out like a sore thumb. So there were only 5 number one albums in 1984 dominated the charts. There was Thriller. There was the Footloose soundtrack, which also Kenny Loggins. Sports by Huey Lewis and the News. Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen. And then Purple Rain by Prince. You would have either said the soundtrack sticks out because yep. it's a soundtrack or
Purple Rain.
No, or Sports. So that's why Huey was there, and Huey was almost in awe that he was there, too, and almost in awe that he got to sing a solo.
Well, so he got his solo at the last minute, which I want to talk about with Prince.
Right.
And he didn't have an attitude about it. Like, some artists would have been like, hey, you're not going to ask me ahead of time? Like, no way, I'm not right. going to do this. I'm better than being your second choice. He just gladly stepped in and was happy to be there and was nervous, wanted to do a good job. And, mm-hmm. you know, and so
he almost felt like it was almost like he felt like he did not belong.
Yes.
And so he was trying his best to not mess up.
That was cool to see. Made you think like you feel like he's a good guy in real life.
Yes.
Okay.
Who's after Huey?
It's for me to know and you to find out. No. Cyndi Lauper.
Yes.
Cyndi and her Lauper. Noisy necklaces.
Woo! Her noisy necklaces and her bright colored hair and her 4 top 5 hits in 1984. Top 5. Not top 40, top 5.
Cyndi Lauper.
Yeah, you just said that.
Kim Carnes.
Yeah, Kim Carnes had 8 top 40 hits in the 80s, including one of the 2 biggest songs of the 80s, which was, of course, was Betty Davis Eyes, although that had been a few years earlier, but she's famous for duets with Kenny Rogers and then tripods with Kenny Rogers and James Ingram.
Okay, here we go. Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan, a legacy, and a legacy only because he had no hits in the 1980s.
Was he just a pity vote?
I don't think he was a pity vote. I think when you have somebody like that wants to come in, you're just like, yeah, come on in.
Do you think he wanted to come in on it?
Why would he have been there if he didn't want to come in on it?
He just seemed so awkward. And last but not least, Ray Charles.
Another legacy. Mm. Owner of 33 top 40 hits. Only one in the 80s. But, ooh, I love me some Ray Charles.
Okay, so these people sang in the chorus. Dan Aykroyd, we'll talk about why in a little while. Harry Belafonte, Lindsey Buckingham.
Yes.
Mario Cipollina, I don't know who that
is. He's one of the News.
Johnny Cola.
Also one of the News.
Sheila E.
Not one of the News.
Bob Geldof. Bill Gibson.
Also of the News.
Chris Hayes.
Also of the News.
Sean Hopper.
Also of the News.
Jackie Jackson.
Of the Jacksons.
LaToya Jackson. Marlon Jackson, Randy Jackson, Tito Jackson.
All the Jacksons.
Waylon Jennings, Bette Midler, John Oates, Jeffrey Osborne, Anita June, and Ruth Pointer, and Smokey Robinson.
All right, so let's talk about some of these folks. I want to know, why didn't Smokey get a solo part?
So I want to know, why did Smokey not get a solo part, and why didn't Bette Midler get something?
Well, because Bette Midler should have been punted out of the out of the studio because she did not belong.
Really?
Because she would go on to record Wind Beneath My Wings.
Oh, stop it. Stop it. Stop it. So, but we let Dan in? Who let Dan in?
Paul Simon.
So
Paul Simon and Dan are really good friends.
Uh-uh.
Yes.
Well, that's not, I mean, I didn't hear that they weren't friends, but I heard that that Dan Aykroyd just happened to be at the right place at the right time.
And that may have been too.
And that he accidentally walked into the office of a talent manager who had clients who had committed mm-hmm. to the recording session, and he heard it being talked about and was basically like, I'm going, like, you can't stop me kind of a thing.
That's funny. So Paul Simon and Dan Aykroyd were good friends because Paul Simon was on SNL a lot in the first 5 years.
That makes sense. But again.
But can we go back to my question about Smokey?
Yeah, I was going to say, but again, why did Smokey not get something?
Smokey should have got a solo.
I mean, Drunk Al was all over
the place. Well, that's what I was going to say. I would have given it to him over Al Jarreau. I would have given it to him over Paul Simon. I don't know if I would have booted anybody else out of there. But, yeah, I feel like Smokey has one of the best voices of all time.
Oh, absolutely.
How does he not get a solo in this song? And what about Jeffrey Osborne? He could have jumped in with On the Wings of Love.
Oh, I'm so glad that he didn't. So let me get this out of the way because it makes me uncomfortable and I just want to talk about it and move on from it. So Waylon Jennings was there. Waylon he's on my Mount Rushmore.
Of country singers.
Yeah. So I have a hard time reconciling this, but so he was there. He would have been part of the chorus. Stevie got a little carried away and decided at some point that they should maybe start singing something in Swahili. And the more Stevie started singing in Swahili, the more upset Waylon Jennings got. And then finally, Waylon was like, yeah, that's it. I'm out of here. He's quoted as saying, well, ain't no good old boy ever sung Swahili. Think I'm out of here.
So, I know that upsets you and
disappointed.
That upset me at first too, but can I explain something?
Hold on. It implies something that I don't think is true about mm-hmm. Waylon. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't look good.
It does not look good. But let me say this. Waylon was not the only one that was upset and against singing Swahili. A bunch of artists.
Well, I mean, listen, it turns out they don't speak Swahili in Ethiopia.
I know. So well, that was one thing. But a bunch of artists were like, no, 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 this isn't right. Waylon walked out because he thought it was going to sound disrespectful. And that is why walked out.
Well, thank you for putting that new light on it. Because I was like, oh, Waylon, really?
And Ray Charles even yelled out, it's 3 o'clock in the bleeping morning. I can barely sing in English. I ain't singing in no Swahili.
Do you get the idea that, like, Stevie Wonder doesn't care what time it is? Like, yeah. Like when he gets into that creative process,
yes.
Like, I bet days go by and he's, like, yeah. not even aware.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting if you step back and you watch, speaking of Ray Charles, wasn't he a little bit like the conductor as needed?
I don't know.
I felt like that. He was. Like, occasionally, if things started getting a little bit maybe out of hand, like the whole Swahili thing, you know, Ray would kind of speak up and everybody would like, okay, well, yeah, calm back down.
Ray's the elder statesman there. So he, you know, he kind of gets that respect.
At one point, Stevie Wonder basically threatened everybody if they didn't get their part in one take that he and Ray Charles would be driving everybody home.
Yes. Yes, which Stevie can drive. I've told you that.
He cannot drive. Stop with that. Oh.
They said that Stevie knew his way to the bathroom. He was like, come here, let me show you. Ray was like, I need to use the bathroom. And Stevie was like, come on, let me show you.
Well, and apparently, like, he knew exactly where it was. Like, he really did lead him to the bathroom.
Exactly.
Like, that just blows my mind.
That's, you know why? Because he can see.
What, the whole thing has been a ruse?
Yes, it's a big conspiracy theory.
So something else about Stevie Wonder that I admired about him was, so Bob Dylan was totally out of his element.
Yes.
So awkward. You know, I have this thought that Bob Dylan is awkward in life, just period. Wherever he's at right now, Bob Dylan is awkward.
Probably.
But put him in a group of so many, like, super talented musicians, and he was just like, wow, not just, like, fitting in. And he was nervous.
Yes.
And basically, they called Stevie Wonder over to imitate Bob Dylan to Bob Dylan.
Yes.
Because Bob Dylan got nervous. He was unsure about how to sing, how to sound, what to do. So Stevie's really good at...
I was going to say, that apparently that's one of his talents, is that he can imitate another singer.
So they brought him over. It's something that Lionel did. Come on over here. And Stevie imitated Bob Dylan to Bob Dylan, and that calmed him down, helped him know, oh, this is how they want me to sound. And that's so funny to me.
Right. Bob Dylan clearly looked uncomfortable there. So Bob Dylan's talent is not singing, right? It's songwriting.
What is it?
It's songwriting. Bob Dylan is a songwriter. He is a poet. He is not one of the great singers.
Okay,
and so he felt uncomfortable with all these fantastic singers there. Who wouldn't?
The first time I ever saw Bob Dylan was on an award show. I don't know. I should really go back and maybe Google, see if I can figure it out. Maybe 88?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Would he have had a reason to be on an award show in 88? Anyways, he came out and stood with his back to the audience. It was, I think, probably his way of protesting something, right?
Right.
And, you know, being 7, 8, 9 years old, and I'm watching this, I'm like, what is this dude doing? And I'll never forget, my mom's like, oh yeah, that's just Bob Dylan. That's just what he does. And it's just like, so that like has always stuck with me. Like, oh, that's just Bob Dylan. That's what he does. Like, I thought he was off, right? Little Lynn's interpreted that as like, oh, this dude's like done way too many drugs, right? Or like, he's not all there. And like, he didn't understand he was standing with his back to the audience. So I naturally just go back to that when I talk about Bob Dylan. And it's like, no,
I bet you have aged now, and I bet you I could play you 4 or 5 Bob Dylan tracks that you would actually enjoy.
We should do that sometime and just see. Okay, so Lindsey Buckingham, I mean, why is he there? He brought nothing.
Well, he brings a fantastic voice, and he's also the lead singer and lead guitar player of one of the biggest bands of the late 70s and early 80s.
I know, but I'm just saying, like, that night specifically, it didn't seem like he brought anything to the table.
I mean, they didn't ask him to bring anything to the table. They asked him to be right next to Dan Aykroyd and sing. I mean, what are you going to do if you're next to Dan Aykroyd and you're singing? Or maybe you're in between two of the news.
So, Cyndi Lauper, she almost no-showed the whole thing. So her boyfriend, whatever doofus she was dating at the time, was basically like, oh, this isn't going to be good for your
career,
your reputation, whatever. I don't think you should do it. So Lionel got wind of that and, you know, talked to her and like calmed her down and everything. But that's so funny. She was taking career advice from some like boyfriend?
Yes, some Vanilla Ice dude
or something. Yeah, I mean, okay.
So do you feel like we need to send Lionel over to the Middle East right now to host peace talks between Israel and Iran and the Palestinians? Because I feel like he can talk anybody into anything.
Yes, yes. And he does it in a way that they end up agreeing to do it and not even realize that he's really twisted their arm in doing it.
Right. And because he does it with that smooth, soulful voice.
Yep. And the sad thing is like, you know, this generation thinks that Lionel Richie is just
a judge on American Idol.
Yeah. I mean, that's insane to me. So, okay. I've left some of the more uncomfortable things for the end here that I want to tackle. I am bothered by the Prince Sheila E. situation.
Yes.
So they had invited Sheila E. to participate. She apparently was super honored and very excited to do it. And were they dating? Was she dating Prince close?
She had been part of his band, and I think that, yes, they had dated, and she was just going out on her own, but they intimated that Prince was in love with her.
And it was, she felt like as the night wore, they told her she would have a solo. She felt like as the night went on and she's looking forward to doing her solo, that they're just like, hey, is Prince coming? When's Prince going to get here? And she started to feel like she was just kind of stuck in the middle, and that they didn't really want her. They were just trying to get to Prince. And so along with Waylon, she actually left.
Yes. I feel like she was being used, for sure.
I am not comfortable with that. That really irritates me. And I wish that Lionel had addressed that.
In the documentary?
In the documentary.
Yeah.
Because maybe he could have said something that would have made me feel a little better about that situation.
I don't know if it was him that was doing
it. Oh, I'm sure it was. It probably wasn't. But again, if he's going to be the peacekeeper, I'm going to need to hear from him.
Right.
So Prince, but then also, you know, I'm annoyed with Prince and his, he apparently kept calling and talking to her. And at one point, Lionel got on the phone with him and was talking to Prince. And Prince is down the street. And he's, my interpretation, he's just being stubborn or difficult or whatever. And it's like, dude, just put your ego aside and get over there. I guess they wanted a Prince and Michael like thing, you know, because they were the two biggest stars at the time.
Right.
And just Prince wasn't going to do it. And it was like, he couldn't put his own ego aside to do it.
You talk about Bob Dylan being awkward. I would say that Prince is just as awkward. And apparently Prince doesn't like to be around crowds. I know he was at the music awards. I know he performs in concert, but he doesn't have to be personal with those people.
Well, he doesn't anymore.
Well, back then, he would not have been comfortable in a situation around 50 people that would have wanted to talk to him and whatever. So
apparently he did offer after the fact to do like a guitar solo, but that just really wasn't
right. That wasn't
part of the whole thing. Did you hear that Stevie Wonder invited Eddie Murphy to participate? But at the time, Eddie Murphy was working on his single Party All the Time. And he was like, no, I'm too busy. I don't have time for that. And then later, Eddie Murphy is quoted as saying, by the time he realized, you know, what it was, he felt like an idiot.
Yeah, I can see that. But he didn't know what it was.
Right. But can you imagine trying to do this today? I just don't know that it would be possible to do this today. Social media, the internet, cell phones. Like, I don't think you could do it. No, I don't think you could pull it off.
They'd do it over Zoom.
Yeah, maybe. That's a good point. So can I give you some of the deets of the song?
Sure.
We Are the World was released March 7th, 1985 as the first single from the album by Columbia Records. It topped music charts throughout the world and became the fastest-selling U.S. pop single in history. It was certified quadruple platinum, becoming the first single to be certified multi-platinum. Its awards include 4 Grammys, 1 American Music Award, and a People's Choice Award. It is the 8th best-selling physical single of all time. The promotion and merchandise helped We Are the World raise more than $80 million. That equates to $222 million today for humanitarian aid in Africa and the U.S.
Well, I hope they got it all.
The famine, the 83 to 85 famine in Ethiopia killed about 1 million people.
That's horribly sad. Horribly sad. Picking it back up, so we're not just sitting here in our sadness. So you mentioned that Prince didn't show up.
Yes.
So there were a few big artists that I noticed that weren't included in this, and I'm not sure why, but Prince was one of them. Madonna was one of them.
So I can't picture Madonna being able to do that and not make it all about her. But what do you think? Why was she not?
I don't know. I know that one of the people there were talked about, you know, wanting Madonna, like Madonna was on her wish list and she didn't get it. I was trying to think of other big artists back for that time that weren't there. I can't, not a lot's coming to me. Tom Petty, maybe. Tom Petty wasn't there. He could have been there and made Dylan feel more comfortable.
Right.
You mentioned Roy Orbison earlier.
He was too old by then, don't you think?
Well, I mean, he had hits with the Traveling Wilburys.
That's true.
A few years later, so that's I don't think he was too old. But
there was no one from the Beatles.
That's because they're all British.
And
this was American music. So
we couldn't invite somebody with an accent?
No.
Why?
The only non-American there was Bob Geldof. And that's because he started this all. This was nothing but American artists.
I don't like these rules.
It was after the American Music Awards. It wasn't after the Grammys. Okay. It was after the American Music Awards.
I don't know what else to say to that. But do you remember at any point, I just have like a vague memory of this. And so like radio stations at some point trying to like all get together and play it at the same time. Like it was going to be simulcast across like every radio station. I feel like I remember that.
I don't remember that. I thought maybe that was Hands Across America.
Oh, that's funny. I don't remember Hands Across America, but I remember We Are the World like very vividly. I remember like my cousins trying to explain to me, you know, that there were people starving in other countries and I just couldn't like relate to that. Like I remember this like being a dinner time conversation.
I remember hearing that. And then our parents would always use the clean your plate because they're starving kids over in Africa.
Yes.
Line. And my thought was always, well, you can't ship this over to Africa now. Like it's been used.
Right.
I get their point though. But I've got something for you.
Okay.
All right. So Al Jarreau, you mentioned that you didn't really like the way. Yeah, Drunk Al. So I'm fine with having an Al in there, but maybe we take out the Jarreau and add in Green.
Oh, yeah. Now you're talking.
Al Green.
Do you know how much I love Al Green?
I do not.
Oh, well. I love me some Al Green. So anything that's good is just going to be better with Al Green in it.
Right. So we talked earlier about Michael, you know, just singing perfectly on pitch. Then Lionel sang, and Lionel had a wonderful voice. And then you had, you know, James Ingram and Kenny Rogers and Stevie Wonder and all them singing just wonderful voices. But then when Diana Ross started to sing, I'm not talking about in the actual song, but just when they were like practicing and stuff like that, literally brought tears to my eyes. Like I was amazed at all these great artists. And then all of a sudden Diana Ross starts singing and her voice was just so beautiful and so perfect that it literally brought tears to my eyes.
You know what? I guess I'm glad that you brought this up because we were sitting watching the documentary together, you on one side of the couch, me on the other. And I, you know, she sings and I just happened to look over at you and like, he's serious. There were tears in his eyes. And I'm like, you didn't cry at our wedding. You didn't cry when Emmy was born. Like, I've seen you cry maybe twice in 15 years and you were crying over Diana Ross. I was so like, is he PMSing? What is going on?
I wasn't crying over Diana Ross, but you know that there is something that music does to the soul. We were made for music.
I mean, apparently you were made for Diana Ross.
No. Diana Ross is an old lady now.
She's still very, a very pretty lady.
Yes, she is. So Diana Ross's voice, Steve Perry's voice, Daryl Hall's voice, they all just blew me away.
Yeah, I agree on that. I didn't feel like crying, but I agree.
That's because you don't get goosebumps when you hear music,
and right.
I do.
I know.
So I can't control that.
I know. It's so crazy to me. I'm not a big crier either, but anyways. So how cool was it? I just don't want to not talk about Quincy Jones. Like, I feel like we kind of maybe
glossed over him
a little bit. And I just want to, like, he was working on the music for The Color Purple, and he stopped that to do this.
Yes.
And then went back on, and I absolutely love The Color Purple. So I was just like, oh my gosh, that is so cool. You've never heard me say that I love The Color Purple.
No, I never
have. That look on your face. I do. I do. And so he was, like, obviously the backbone to the entire thing. And
yes.
It wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for him.
Quincy put it all together. And he brought his boy that was really good at putting different musicians, the sounds of different musicians' voices together one after another.
Yes.
And that's how we ended up with the lineup that we ended up
with.
Which
was like genius. And I don't even, I mean, that dude was next level talented because he knew to put who, I'm like, who was it? It was Willie Nelson. Was it, Drunk Al?
Dion, then Willie, then Al, then Bruce.
And he knew like that all of the, they would all go together.
And then Kenny Loggins, Steve Perry, Daryl Hall.
That's craziness. And then he knew, don't give anything to Oates because he can't sing.
Yes, yes. I think he might have not been in favor of having Dylan in there, too.
Right?
At least he surrounded Dylan by Kim Carnes and Ray Charles.
We could look at that list, and if you look back now and you go, maybe one person shouldn't be on there, who would it be?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I'm going to go with Paul Simon.
I'm going to say something that's going to get you all fired up.
You are, aren't you?
Kim Carnes.
But she's got Betty Davis eyes.
I mean, I know, but...
Well, in fairness, they only gave her two words as her solo. It was literally two words.
Yes, which is, I think I might be like, never mind if that's all they offered
me. It was supposed to be another word or two, and that's when Huey and Cindy jumped in. They did like a tripod with the three of them.
Yeah, Cindy felt like a little out of control to me. And her jiggling jewelry that was making noises on the...
But her voice is crazy, too.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
So was there anybody else big missing that you can think of besides Prince and Madonna?
Who was missing?
There was somebody else big missing that I wanted to write down, and I didn't, and now I've forgotten who it was.
You know why? Because you're 50.
Boy, that 50-year-old brain doesn't work like the 20-year-old brain did.
Do you think that maybe they didn't want Madonna and Cyndi Lauper both, and then they felt like Cyndi might be easier to deal with?
Possibly.
I mean, I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there, seeing what sticks.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know anything, you know, about them.
Oh, I know.
Personally.
I know.
Who?
John Denver.
John Denver?
John Denver.
What about John Mellencamp?
John Mellencamp! What in the world? How can I leave off John Cougar Mellencamp?
I don't know.
So, John Denver asked to participate.
Did he really?
And they said no.
I noticed they didn't have any of the Eagles in here either.
Okay, I'm going to say something else. I know the answer, but I have to throw it out there. Freddie Mercury.
English.
I know, but still, Freddie Mercury, come on.
English.
Could there have been another country artist? What about Dolly?
Yeah, Dolly. I'm actually kind of surprised Dolly wasn't a part of that. I mean, they could have had Ronnie Millsap in there. Then you would have had three blind mice.
Jim.
What?
I'm very uncomfortable making fun of blind people because I'm over here half blind.
Well, I am more than half blind.
Oh.
I'm like a mole.
Well, this has been fun. I really enjoyed the documentary. If you haven't seen it already, watch it on Netflix. The Greatest Night in Pop.
I would say that, yeah, that it would do a better job of breaking this down than we just did.
Were you saying we didn't do a good job?
I'm just saying they have the ins and outs and we...
Well, I mean, they've got Lionel.
Yes,
exactly. I mean, I don't have Lionel.
Well, if we did...
I don't have access to
you
him.
You know what? Let's put him on our list of guests that we'll interview next week.
Okay, perfect.
What do you think?
Perfect.
I enjoyed going back and talking about this because, like you said, this was one of the biggest singles of the 1980s. I remember this being on all the time. One more question. How many times did they say We Are the World? I say 172.
Definitely 94.
94.
Okay, well, I guess this wraps up our rundown of the Netflix documentary, The Greatest Night in Pop.
We Are the World by USA for Africa. This was a lot of fun. So if you enjoyed this episode, please give us a 5-star rating and review on whatever platform you listen to us. Tell somebody about it. Spread the word. You know, those 5 stars helped with the algorithm, you know, making us be able to be seen more when people are searching for podcasts. So if this is something you enjoy and you want more people to enjoy it, we'd appreciate that review.
I want to hear from people. I want to know who they thought was left out, who they thought
should have been left out.
Should have been left out, who they enjoyed, who surprised them. I want some feedback.
Yeah, I want to hear about this because this it's an eclectic group of artists. So there was a little bit of something for everybody.
So I thought on the way out here, I thought maybe I might play a little snippet of it.
Yeah,
is that absolutely. Okay? Mm-hmm. Do you have anything you want to say before we wrap up?
I want to say I'm glad that they raised $80 million for Ethiopian famine.
Yeah, me too. And so we all must lend a helping hand.